Movie Squad is sponsored by Luna Palace Cinemas, WA's premier independent cinemas, bringing the best film content and cinematic events to Perth. Come and enjoy the Luna Palace experience.
Toast.
Toast.
Right here. Right now. The most important thing in life will always be the
Movie Squad.
Salute me, familia.
Welcome to the Movie Squad podcast. My name is Tristan Fidler.
And my name is Simon Morado.
This is a podcast version of your weekly edition of Movie Chat, broadcasting on RTRFM 92.1, Friday morning, 7:30 a.m. with breakfast host Pam Boland. And on this special edition, well, it's a special edition in that it's post, well, Radiothon continues, but for the last couple of episodes, we were in the throng of Radiothon activity, and now we're back to business doing reviews, and including in this episode, a bonus review for your podcast listeners, checking in with the latest entry into the Alien franchise, Alien Romulus. But before we get to that, we're going to listen to what we said on air, which is also talking about, you know, two films with very different tones and vibes, as you say, Simon. What is the film that you cover?
And the second half of the episode, I take a look at the Irish language raucous hip-hop biopic Kneecap. And all of us discussing how long we've been fans of this particular band.
That's it. And then, but we also start things off on a bit more of a, well, I mean, in terms of our good morning, it's a solemn note, but this film does get to a solemn place as well. I saw the TV Glow, a new independent art house movie, drama, a little bit horror, a little bit mystery, from director Jane Schoenbrunn, from A24 Studios, Emma Stone's production company, starring Justice Smith. And we're going to hear a little bit from the trailer right now.
I know this might sound crazy. I don't want to alarm you.
Do you remember a TV show we used to watch together? It was called...
The Big of Eight?
Yeah. Do you watch?
Each episode, they help each other fight a new monster from across the county.
But it's way too scary for most kids.
We're gonna defeat him this time. We're gonna need to harness the full potential of our shared powers.
Sometimes the Pink Opaque feels more real than real life.
Maddie, it was a TV show.
Are you sure that's all it was?
Every Friday here on Breakfast, we do take some time out of the morning for the cinematic arts. We look into the brains of the blockbuster babes. Simon Morado, Tristan Fidler, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes. Oh, that was quite solemn. That was quite... Like menacing almost.
Menacing?
Well, because it was quite like downcut. There was no like, good morning. It was like, good morning, you know?
Yeah. You don't know how you're going to feel until the moment strikes.
Yeah.
But I feel great.
But you both felt the same there. Yeah.
Tristan, how do you feel?
I didn't realize that it was... I thought there was a brightness to my voice, but maybe I was just giving off... not good energy.
No,
I don't know, but
no,
like
it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad.
Mm, yeah. But, you know, I mean, it's always something that we can rehearse and practice, and maybe to, you know, yeah, make sure that it's not too solemn.
Yeah.
Well, look,
yeah.
We could be coming down from the, I think, meth-like high of last week's Radiothon show, where the energy was so insane.
Yeah.
But it was lovely to have Ange Tufnell in
it
sharing
was.
Limericks. And Pam, we enjoyed your game as well.
Yeah.
But now we're back to the business of Movie Squad, which
back
is...
Back to regular programming. No games, all business.
Stone-faced film criticism.
Yes, yes.
That's what we're known for. Yes, all of those really hectic reviews. I'm so glad that we detoured into me focused on the good morning and we forgot to say the thank yous. But also there is lots of thank yous to go out this morning to everyone that's mentioned Movie Squad in their subscriptions or their donations. It's still Radiothon despite the, you know, slightly more levelled behaviour on the Movie Squad moment this morning. If you want to subscribe or mention Movie Squad or you want to donate during the recording, donate this morning, you still can at rtrfm.com.au.
And on that note, Pam, just very quickly, one of the things we used to do is actually say, if there was a film that you discovered via Movie Squad, because today we're talking about, you know, film reviews again, and we're talking about art house, you know, less, you know, sort of under the radar movies to a degree. If there was a film you heard about on Movie Squad, discovered it, and then loved it, you know, chuck a $5, $10 donation in. Why not?
Yeah, well, how much did it cost to get something from, like, a video rental store back in the day?
Like $7? Was that how much an overnighter was?
Right. Yeah, that's, you know, a new release.
10 weeklies for, yep.
Yeah, yeah. Or you could get a special deal. So you mentioned 10 films.
I remember going in my pajamas and being so excited. And I feel like sometimes listening to Movie Squad is kind of like getting one of those borrows, because you don't really know like what you're taking out, but you can read the back of the DVD packet or the VHS, much like you can listen to us, you know, spout about it a little bit.
What a beautiful way to describe the reviews that Tristan and I deliver. Spout. Yes, like the back of a DVD packet.
It's kind of like the back of a DVD pack, but with, like, personality, you know?
Right.
Well, let's get into our first DVD for the morning.
Yes.
This one is something that I've been anticipating. I've been, like, hanging out for it. It did have a bit of a sort of, it felt like a lead-up that felt very culturally exciting. It's got lots of people that I care about. Mm. I'm really excited to talk about it. Tristan, tell me about I Saw the TV Glow.
I Saw the TV Glow is a new film from director Jane Schoenbrunn. Their previous film was something that we reviewed a couple of years ago called We're All Going to the World's Fair, and something that we reviewed positively. I know that you were a big fan of, Simon.
Yeah, it was maybe my second or third favourite film of 2022, but a fantastic, very frightening and unnerving tale about a girl getting sucked into a sort of internet wormhole. And the film had lots of surprises up its sleeve, but was very, felt very homemade, and that was part of the terrifying nature of it.
Yes, and so with this Schoenbrunn's next film, there's a bit of a bigger budget. It's produced by A24 and also Emma Stone's production company as well.
Emma Stone has a production company.
Yeah.
Oh, cool lady.
Cool lady.
Yes, and it was interesting you were talking before about DVDs and video stores, because this film begins in the 90s, and it feels like, connected to that theme of the time when popular culture, television shows, films, whatever, they are like artifacts or relics that you discover at a young age. And whether it is like taking it from the video store shelf and kind of clutching it in your hands, or staying up late to record an episode of The X-Files, which I remember I used to do, waiting for the next one because it wasn't all available to you. You had to kind of really find it for yourself. And that's part of what I Saw the TV Glow is about. And it connects to the previous film as well, because it's all about how identity and psychology becomes wrapped up in media and popular culture. But yeah, we start in 1996 with two teenagers who become connected through their mutual fandom of a TV show, an invented TV show called The Pink Opaque, which you see clips of and is very much modeled on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Nickelodeon shows like The Adventures of Pete and Pete. And if you pay attention, there's a few cameos from both shows in the cast. So it's really invested in that type of show, which is kind of both aimed at teenagers, but is sort of introducing them to this kind of bizarre world, or sort of a little bit like Twin Peaks as well. But we have Owen, who is in primary school, first played by Ian Foreman as a kid, and then later on played by Justice Smith, who people might know from Detective Pikachu and some of the Jurassic World movies.
And that Generation, did you see that? I can't remember what that show was called.
It was called Generation. They were also in The Get Down, the Baz Luhrmann show.
And they were in that movie with, anyway, we don't need to go through that, but I'm trying to think of the things that I remember them from. And that movie with Elle Fanning. Something All the Bright Places or something. Anyway,
right.
They're great. We love them. Great.
Yes. And so they're dealing with things at home. Their mother is going through health issues, and he's a little bit estranged by his father, who I didn't realize until when I was looking up the cast list this week. His father is actually played by Fred Durst from the band Limp Bizkit. So there's lots of little fun like touches like that. But basically, he's alone. One night where they're at school doing voting, he befriends or becomes friendly with Maddie, played by Bridget Lundy Payne, who, you know, you're a fan of Pam?
I just have such a big crush on Bridget Lundy Payne. Yeah. They were in Atypical, that was like a Netflix TV show that ran for a few years that was, I think, based around a family dealing or sort of like living their life with one of the kids had autism. Anyway, I just love Bridget Lundy Payne, just mostly for the crush factor. But, you know, great acting from what I've seen so far.
They also played Bill or Ted's child in Bill and Ted Face the Music.
Oh.
But Keanu Reeves' daughter in that, yes.
Oh, cool.
Doing a very good Keanu Reeves impression as well in that movie. But they become connected through this TV show. They start to, even though they might not talk to each other in the hallways, Maddie leaves recorded episodes for Owen, and occasionally Owen will stay over at Maddie's place to watch it on a Saturday night. At one point, in a very kind of formative coming-of-age moment, Maddie wants to run away. They're tired of their kind of life in this small town, and ask Owen to come with them, and Owen is too scared to and says no, or just does not show up, and then Maddie disappears, and we move forward in time to when Owen is an adult. He's working in a kind of amusement,
like a kids' play center sort of thing.
Or first he works in a cinema, I should say. First he works in a cinema, and then in a kids' play thing with a nice appearance by comedian Connor O'Malley as his obnoxious boss. But really, this. We focus on the mystery of why Maddie disappeared, and then Maddie returns, and it goes from there. There's a lot more to say about this film, but I'm conscious of the time, and also that not to spoil what this film kind of delves into. Well, I mean, we could talk a little bit about it, but this is a very interesting film in that it's very, I think, connected to the feeling of being a teenager. It's very connected to issues of trans identity, but also the relationship between people and popular culture and how it can both like liberate them but also trap them in a way. So it's a very fascinating object. Now, Simon, I know that you've seen this. What did you think of I Saw the TV Glow?
Look, I love this film just as much as the last one, and I think, you know, Jane Schoenbrunn would probably roll her eyes by describing her as a trans filmmaker. But I think that like trans identity is tied up in these two movies, and they are body horror films to a degree. I don't think this film is a horror movie. It kind of has more nightmarish qualities, but what I mean by that is it's about the horror of feeling like you're trapped in a body, right? Or like the both movies, you know, depending on your own vantage point, and I'm not going to say that it has any, you know, accuracy about the trans experience, but these are films about body dysmorphia, and I find that I find that theme to be so powerful, the way that she conveys it through these movies. And again, I don't want to get into the spoilers of the second half of the film per se, but the kind of melancholy of this movie and the tragedy of this movie was just stunningly powerful. And I have to say that it has a very unusual, very unnerving ending that really caught me off guard. And I was kind of left, you know, not really able to speak or gather my thoughts immediately after the film. So I really loved and found this very powerful.
Yeah, I liked this film. I thought the performances are very good, Justice Smith in particular in the lead role. And it does, like, it harks to, like, it reminded me of films like Donnie Darko or, you know, the sense that it's kind of yearning in that sense of the teenage emotions, but it also is a vibes, a wavelength movie. So I think that it can really hit people and knock them out. And then for other people, it might just be like, what I don't really get this. And it's interesting how it uses the television show of The Pink Opaque as a way, I guess, to kind of let people into this idea or experience or the feeling of being trapped. I like the film. I think that I was wanting it to be more mysterious or more surreal, or I think that some of the metaphors are a little bit on one level, but that's my reaction to it as a middle-aged cis person. But yeah, it's got a lot to recommend, and particularly the soundtrack as well, which features people like Carolyn Polachek and Maggie Rogers shows up in one point.
Phoebe Bridges is in the
that's,
film.
That's yeah. who I meant, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe, you know, they're both blonde.
Well, she and is it Sloppy Jane? They perform a song together in the movie.
Yeah.
And then King Snail, Queen also performs in
Snail
it.
Snail Mail's in it.
Lindsay Jordan plays one of the actors in The Pink Opaque.
Yeah,
Francis Quinlan, Yule, Florist, and Alex G did the score.
Yes.
As they did for We're All Going to the World's Fair.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And that score is incredible, and there's a great original song from that. So, yeah, I think if you've seen We're All Going to the World's Fair, and I appreciate that's still, you know, a fairly fringe movie, but I do highly recommend it, I think it is that same wavelength.
Mm.
I feel very tuned into that wavelength.
Yes.
For a variety of reasons, and I really love it, but totally respect Tristan that it didn't work to that same level for you.
Well, I liked it, but I mean, it's definitely a film that I think, you know, should be seen in the cinema. It's very visual. It's very kind of atmospheric. And I know that you haven't seen it, Pam, but I feel like even though there's this element of horror to it, I do feel like it's not the same type of horror that sometimes we review or talk about in other shows.
It's Twin Peaks horror. I think that's the closest analog.
I think this is the movie that this is a movie I really want to see. Mm. And I did have the opportunity to see it before this, before us talking about it this morning. But I got a bit scared because I was home alone that night. And I just was a little bit, I wasn't willing to risk the fear. But I don't think it sounds like something that I can't handle or can't manage. And the cast is so great. The soundtrack is great. And I think the sort of, cultural discussion or the sort of like the buzzy lead up to this when, you know, Caroline Polachek's releasing a track and I was like, what's, I saw the TV glow and it's in the album cover and it's an A24 movie. So, and it's set in 1996. That's the year I was born. So, you know, I just want, it feels like it was like, Pam, watch this movie. So I do really want to watch it and I want to see the performances and understand where those tracks come in. I think it's definitely going to go on the list for me. Is it coming out in cinemas?
It is in cinemas right now. I definitely think, I echo Tristan's thoughts. It's got a great big screen vibe to it. So, yeah, go and check out I Saw the TV Glow.
We're going to get into a little bit of the soundtrack. This is Caroline Polachek with Starburned and Unkissed.
Tell me something about you. Something you've never told anyone else.
I'm a rapper. There are 80,000 native Irish speakers in Ireland.
Ní fach, I chéad gan teanga, ach la náisiúm.
Three of us have become rappers.
You may know the words, but you don't understand the language.
Which means you're real for a horse from Kjol.
Josh, I go studio again.
What?
August Wrench Beats.
Can you like? Well, you hear Abbey Road, eh?
Abbey what?
We're catching up with the Blockbuster Babes to get across all things movies. Now, we don't only do the all things movies thing just on the radio. There's also great ways that you can go and experience these people in real life appreciating movies. Tristan, how are you doing that tonight?
Yes, just a short plug for Trash Classics is back in session for Program 7 for the rest of this year. So at the last Friday of every month at Luna. And tonight we're screening Barbarella, so our first film from the 60s, the 1968 sci-fi camp cult classic with Jane Fonda, and it's co-presented by the Perth Comic Arts Festival. And there's a original poster that they've made that you can win on the night if you dress up in 60s theme. But yeah, that's tonight, and see it before the Sydney Sweeney remake, whenever that happens.
Yeah.
But that's been announced.
I mean, I love that. They're both kind of like bombshells in a great way. So love Jane Fonda. You know, excited to see if Sydney Sweeney does a great job. You know, that sounded so
that's like the kind of thing you get in a performance review. I'm just like, excited to see what comes next.
Anyway, that's going to be happening. Trash Classics, always a gorgeous time. You can always find out a little bit more about it here on Movie Squad. But we're going to get into our second movie for this morning. Simon, talk to me about Kneecap.
Kneecap. Now, if you felt a slight breeze through your car window or at home, that was the vibe shift, because we are moving quite distinctly away from I Saw the TV Glow to a really raucous new musical biopic, Kneecap, about the band Kneecap, starring the members of Kneecap.
Whoa!
Now, Pam, are you a fan of, like, music biopics are almost definitively the worst genre of film?
What?
Yes, but that's just a fact.
What do you mean? That's not a fact, that's an opinion, babe.
Watch out.
There ain't no difference on Movie Squad, let me tell you that much. But Pam, what I want to know from you is, when you watch your music biopics, do you want it to like be as accurate and kind of real as possible, or do you want them to take those flights of fancy and maybe lean into the theatre?
Well, look, I almost want them to go further away from trying to be the real person, because I didn't see that
Back in Black.
Yeah, I didn't see that. I didn't see it, but I saw some clips from it, and I was like, you're trying too hard. Go, like, just do your thing, and it can be about the narrative of her life. It doesn't need to be you, like, badly mimicking her singing. That's embarrassing. And I think that's the flaw with music biopics for me. But I do like them, but I would prefer them to maybe lean away from exactly replicating the sounds or the time and kind of, like, take some liberties with the narrative. But not incorrect factually.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the big, you know, the discussion for me is always, is this better than reading a Wikipedia summary? Because sometimes they just feel like a checklist of, like, they did this, and they did that, and then they did this, and then it's like, and as you say, like, to compare those moments. But that's talking about, like, I guess, artists who are established or popular or known through decades, whereas this is very different in that I knew nothing about this band before.
I also know nothing about Kneecap.
You've never heard of Kneecap?
I've never heard of Kneecap.
Wow.
Is that implicating my... Sometimes I say things on Movie Squad and I feel like I've like got a black mark, you know?
Well,
like
I heard about Kneecap for the first time probably 3.5 weeks ago, so I guess that I had more of
okay.
a...
Cool it with that. Yes. Wow.
So I learned all about Kneecap from this film, and I think what's really interesting about what you said there, Pam, and Tristan, you've seen this as well, so we'll both share our opinions on the movie, is that, you know, it's starring the members of Kneecap, who are an Irish language, primarily, hip-hop outfit.
Oh.
And they, you know, very proud about reclaiming the indigenous language of Ireland. And the film is about that struggle. But they are also this kind of... party anthem, you know, hip hop troupe who rap about, you know, the hard and fast times of being a young person in Northern Ireland. And, you know, they definitely aspire to hip hop mythology. And I think this is very much a Print the Legend style music biopic where even though they are playing themselves and they're actually very good in the three lead roles, they are leaning into the mythos of what it means to be a member of Kneecap. So just very briefly, you know, the plot, as much as it is one. So Liam and Nisha are the two main lads in Kneecap. They are, you know, kind of, they call themselves part of the ceasefire generation, right?
Sure.
Nisha's dad, Arlo, played by Michael Fassbender here, he was sort of a Republican paramilitary. He faked his own death to get away from the cops because he had, you know, done some bombings around Northern Ireland. You know, he kind of looms large in their town, but also in their lives. Their form of retaliation and rebelliousness is just to reclaim the Irish language. So I think they feel a little, you know, defeatist about that.
Are they rapping in Gaelic?
Yes, that's right.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
They do rap in English as well, but that primarily it is about them trying to reclaim that language. And then what do they say, Tristan? That every word spoken in the Irish language is another bullet in the gun for Irish rights or something to that,
yes,
to that degree.
Okay.
And so one night Liam is arrested. He refuses to speak English to the police. So they bring in an Irish teacher to translate. And this is JJ, who becomes the third member of the band. He is sort of a straight-laced teacher who discovers their notebook of raps. And then there's a great moment where he goes home and his garage is a fully fitted out recording studio.
What?
And he starts laying a beat under it. And the film kind of comes to life. And it definitely much, and they will probably also hate me saying this, but it is probably indebted to the films of an English filmmaker like Guy Ritchie early on. Trainspotting, absolutely.
Yes.
And then even films like Shane Meadows' La Donkin Score, Zazy, and other music sort of comedies. Now, Tristan, I thought this was a really fun, energetic film that does actually touch on some serious themes because it does get into, you know, the Republican movement and other elements of Irish independence. How did you feel about Kneecap?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. And it's funny, like, it's to me, it's somewhere between, you know, that going back to Trainspotting, that kind of big beat, in-your-face energy, or, you know, Beastie Boys music videos, the kind of just like the raucousness of just like running away and being, you know, just, you know, selling drugs and just being like, you know. But there's a point to it all and everything. But there's also what you were saying at the start, the biopic kind of genre, or even something like Billy Elliot, because like, 9 out of 10, if there's a movie where a parent finds out that their kid is a musician and disapproves of it, you know, in that climactic concert, they're going to show up. And that's what happens in this film.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's a spoiler because, like, I feel like they're very conscious about the sort of the cliches that they're using. And it's all kind of bringing in, well, it's introducing the band, I guess, to a wider audience, but also this discussion, which is current in the past couple of years of the Irish language being recognized, being institutionalized, and not being kind of dismissed or controlled. So that's, I think, a really interesting part to what is basically like an introduction to this band. And the songs are good.
The songs are great. and we should say that we reviewed a movie a couple of years ago called The Quiet Girl that was also in the Irish language, and that was Oscar nominated, I believe. And Ireland has put forward Kneecap as their submission for best international feature film at the upcoming Academy Awards, so that'll be quite interesting. Should note, it was co-written with the band by Rich Pepiat, who also directed the film. And it is so funny you citing the whole parent at the final gig moment, because I'd completely glossed over that, but yes. So it does tick a lot of those boxes, but I think the tongue is firmly planted in cheek for the most part. It's too long. It's about 100 minutes, but it should be probably closer to 80, I think, for the kind of vibe we're going for here. But Kneecap, it's in cinemas now, and it is a lot of energetic fun, even if you've never heard the band.
Oh, love to hear it. Love to hear that. We're going to get into a track from the band, so you can get a little taste up.
Language warning.
Yes, yeah, strong language
warning.
If you
speak Gaelic.
I have the button. They're probably swearing in English as well, aren't they?
Maybe they are. Yeah.
Anyway, we'll find out. Let's hit the button. Anyway, that's Movie Squad for this week. You can get it wherever you get your podcast. Subscribe and go watch Kneecap and I Saw the TV Glow. Thanks to Blockbuster Babes.
Bye.
Well, there you have it. Another great pair of reviews of different tones in terms of what you might want from cinema and what you might get when you go to the movies to see them. But both I thought were good in that I was happy to come back and talk about these two movies on the air.
Yeah, it is nice after, you know, it's been 3 weeks since we've reviewed films specifically, and I was certainly very pleased to have on the docket after, you know, a long way or a long time away from the movies, you know, and I appreciate I obviously liked TV Glow more than you, but nice to have a couple of really interesting films to kind of sink our teeth into now that we're past the sort of morass of blockbuster releases, even though we are sort of referred to somewhat ironically as the Blockbuster Babes.
Yes. And to, you know, highlight those movies that are a bit more, you know, alternative, independent, you know, and that's part of the mission of RTR and putting the spotlight on alternative voices. And definitely, you know, across the two films, there are different voices being heard that you don't often get in the conglomerates, the corporations, and the franchises that are more and more taking up a room at the cinemas.
Now, with that said,
great segue to a film, a franchise that is about the company or about the corporation. But I thought we didn't cover it when it came out. It's been out in cinemas for a couple of weeks now. But to do a review of Alien Romulus, which is the new entry in the Alien franchise. Now, we've talked about Alien previously. There's an older episode of Movie Squad that you can go back to that was all about Alien, the first one, directed by Ridley Scott in time for its anniversary that year. But I know you're a fan of horror, Simon. I know that you're a fan of running the franchise occasionally. Where do you stand with the Alien movies? Have you seen them all?
Have I seen them all? Yeah, I've seen them all except the Alien vs. Predator films, which I know they're canonical, but they're not really canonical.
Sure.
But I've definitely seen all the Alien, you know, the core franchise films. And Alien falls into the same category as X-Men franchise to me.
Sure, sure.
Which is they keep making them and they keep getting worse.
Oh.
You know? So I think, I certainly like the Alien franchise more than X-Men. And obviously, Alien 1, brilliant. Mm. Aliens, brilliant. These are two of my favorite films, you know? And I was even fairly fond of Prometheus when it came out, but I haven't revisited it. But Alien 3, Resurrection, certainly Covenant, they have all, and there was another one, I'm forgetting one, but maybe I'm not. But they do proceed to disappoint.
Sure.
So Romulus, I was excited about, but I am here keen to hear your thoughts because I've been burnt enough that I'm waiting. I'm waiting for this one.
Yeah, and what you're talking about, I want to talk about as well. But I'll talk well, about Alien Romulus,
yes,
and then to circle back on my thoughts of the franchise and as we go on with more films and more TV series as well with an upcoming show by Noah Hawley. But this is directed by Fede Alvarez, who directed the Evil Dead remake, also did Don't Breathe. Now, it's an interesting move because Ridley Scott had returned to the franchise with Prometheus and then with Alien Covenant, and it seemed like that was being part of a trilogy, but the, I think, mixed reaction or the low response to Alien Covenant meant that they shifted, and then we've got the, you know, the mergers and acquisitions of Fox Studios going to Disney, and now it all kind of being underneath the Disney umbrella, which is where Alien as a franchise sits. But when Fede Alvarez was announced, do you like his work? Were you excited about him?
Oh, not particularly. I haven't seen Don't Breathe, and I understand that is good or is better, but I really didn't like his take on Evil Dead, which is the one from 10 years ago, not Evil Dead Rise, which I loved.
Yeah.
That's the small sample size, right? So I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but it definitely didn't excite me to hear that he was on board.
Yeah. And so, you know, he's got experience in doing horror and kind of like muscular thrillers. I do like both those films. Don't Breathe as more of an original film than the Evil Dead remake I did quite like. But yeah, so I was kind of curious about what he would do. And so Alien Romulus promises a sort of return to, I guess, the idea of the first one, or it being kind of like a horror film. We have a cast who are very young, so it's almost like a kind of updated slasher. We do have some recognizable faces. Kaylee Spaney, who has, star has been rising from Priscilla to Civil War, is in the lead role here. And there's a lot of other cast members, which I'll talk about in a moment. But basically, the idea with this one is that we open on a very good opening sequence where mysterious ships collect an asteroid that's been floating in space, and then we realize that this is the kind of calcified remains of the alien that was blown out at the end of the first Alien. So chronologically, this film, Alien Romulus, takes place between Alien and Aliens.
Oh.
So as we go on, we focus on a bunch of young characters who are miners or living on this mining colony. They are basically sort of indentured servants. There's this promise that they can fulfill their contract and leave, but that always gets kind of re-upped. And so the whole thing is that they want to escape and go to another planet, but to do that, they need the cryogenic pods. And there is a space station called Romulus that has been abandoned. It's for some reason kind of belongs to the company, but has kind of been is sort of quiet and still. So they decide to investigate and rob the cryogenic beds that are on this spaceship. But what do you know? Things that are left behind are things like the face huggers, and we get the kind of the usual progression of horror and events. And this tries to, I think, go back to the first Alien in that, you know, there's a slow build-up. It's about 40 minutes before we see the first alien, or that the danger develops. Just to kind of put it shortly, I did enjoy this film. I liked it. I think it is basically a remix of a lot of elements from all the different Alien movies, some of which are good in terms of kind of harkening back to the kind of the horror feeling of some of the earlier ones. But then sometimes it's very cringeworthy when you hear famous dialogue from other movies recycled and reused by different characters. There is a really good performance here by an actor, David Johnson, who plays Andy, who's kind of the android of, you know, every one of these movies, they have the Ripley clone and then they have an android, and he is kind of a brother figure to Kaylee Spaney's character, and is and gives the most interesting performance in terms of what happens to him during the movie and the kind of changes in his personality and the changes in his mission throughout the whole affair. I felt this film got really interesting or really good in the third act, and sometimes it's a matter of like, why can't the whole thing be the third act? So, you know,
make the whole planet a black box.
That's it. That's it. So I did like this, but it did make me think about the Alien franchise and how there's always that kind of excitement about a new film, but ultimately they're always going to be like a version of the first film, and to have all those elements. So, and there's, I won't get into spoilers, but you may have heard about this, Simon. I don't know.
I have.
Yes. There is the use of an actor who has died. They bring back a character, or it's, you know, anyway, it's one of these things that's already happened in movies. People have compared it to Rogue One, where Peter Cushing, his image was brought back, even though the actor had long since passed away. And that is, yeah, probably the low point of the film in how big of a role this character has.
That's my question, because I actually rewatched Rogue One a little while ago now, but it was several years after I'd first seen it. And Peter Cushing's likeness... is very unconvincing and distracting, but it's about three scenes. And I'm not saying that's too little, or I'm not saying that's only a little bit. I'm saying that's actually quite a bit. In this version, are we talking more than three scenes?
I would say so. Like, I wouldn't say it's like, you know, leading role, but like they are an antagonist in this film. And it, it does become like one of those things where you think, well, wasn't there that strike? You know, what did they fight for here?
For this exact reason,
Particularly when it feels like it takes away, you know, what could have been a role for another middle-aged British actor to play the role in, and definitely feels a bit ironic or hypocritical when, you know, a lot of the idea of the Alien movies is this Weyland-Yutani, the corporation that wants the Alien, and the things that they will do to just get that kind of... IP. And so we have another corporation kind of doing the same thing in a different way. So that left a bad taste in my mouth. And there's been a lot of chatter about that. And that's definitely the low point of the film. But yeah, I don't know if this is one to rush out and see. Will you, when it comes to like Disney Plus, will you see it?
I will. And I want to see it. And even though I've heard that the reviews are mixed, I kind of just, you know, I'm a bit of a, I guess, a completionist or a glutton for self-punishment or however you want to phrase it. But here's my question, you know, and I'm not saying that they're all successful because, you know, but at the very least, you have this example of Alien to Aliens, right?
Yeah.
And James Cameron so specifically did not remake Alien.
No.
He made something completely different. But those two films, you know, they at least kind of, I don't want to say it, Aliens understands what's good about Alien. What it does is it takes these core things that are great and uses them for other means.
Yeah.
Being the Ripley character, being this, you know, the xenomorph and the overall setting. And then, whether you like it or not, Alien 3 and Alien 4 and so on and so forth are variations of that. And I guess what I respect about Prometheus was that it did feel quite like it was trying something different. To kind of just flatly remake the first Alien, I don't know, but like, for you, is it the right time? Are you like, yeah, after 40-odd years, there's nothing wrong with just, you know, trying that original recipe again? Or did it feel too much like a rehash?
Well, it's definitely like, it takes parts from all the movies. So there are moments that feel a bit more indebted to Alien 3.
Are you telling me there's a scene where Kaylee Spaney massively dunks a basketball?
Sadly not. That's funny. I was rewatching a whole clip about that moment from Alien Resurrection. But one of the kind of, and I won't go into it, but, you know, I was thinking about a moment in the climax and going, wow, this is so great. And then later on going, oh, I guess this is a version of what happens in Alien Resurrection. And then, you know, Prometheus, that the mythology of those movies is alluded to as well. So it's a bit of kind of like, it's like supermarket sampler. It's like taking parts from all of them. So it doesn't feel like it's adding something really new to the Enterprise. And that's where I find it interesting with franchises and the comparison with Star Wars. Like, you know, love them or hate them. When the prequel trilogy came out, you know, it made lots of money, but a lot of people were not, you know, critically happy with it. But as the more Star Wars, you know, media gets made, now there's reassessment and going, well, George Lucas at least had like ideas, or he was kind of had a vision.
Sure.
And similarly, this film now casts Ridley Scott's kind of versions as being, well, at least he was just using the Alien franchise to explore things that were just interesting to him, which is kind of like the engineers, the god figure, the AI, the character played by Michael Fassbender, David, who sort of becomes the main protagonist between those two movies, Prometheus and Covenant. So I definitely want to revisit those, even though that they had their moments of terribleness. But I think I always like Ridley Scott's vibe, even if he makes kind of boring movies, because he has a very weary, bored countenance that fits in with the kind of nihilistic feel of those two movies, whereas this one doesn't really have that aura of of the darkness of those two movies. So it's interesting as these franchises go on how they kind of, I guess, you know, they make the other ones recess. But then, I guess grew up with the Alien quadrilogy and that excitement of a new director taking up the franchise. But in the end, it's always going to just come back to the same, like, DNA, because you can't... That's what people want. That's what, you know, you can change and mix things around, but it's...
It's like the Marvel House style or James Bond. It, you know, there's only so much you can play with between the boundaries that are now set by the success of the franchise. That's the irony of it, right?
Yes,
like,
yeah.
Ridley could take it this way, James Cameron could take it that way, and then very famously, not even David Fincher, admittedly on his first film, he was heavily constrained by what he could do. Cursed by the success of The Alien as a piece of IP. My question for you, maybe as we wrap up,
is of course.
All people have wanted since Alien 3 is for the aliens to get to Earth, as was famously, that was the teaser for Alien 3, was now they're on Earth.
Mm.
And then they were like, no, actually, they're doing something completely different. And they keep making these films, they just never get there.
Yeah.
And I believe there's now a TV series that is... The premise is that they're kind of making it to Earth, but do you think that does that take the magic away, or is that a fresh new kind of playground?
It's interesting as well, because I didn't realize that about Alien 3, but I know that in one of the original version. Well, I mean, the version, there was a version of the Alien Resurrection script by Joss Whedon where the climax was them arriving at Earth, which didn't end up happening, and then the one Alien movie that I've not seen, which is pretty much the worst one, which is Alien versus Predator Requiem. That's what happens. Like the
is that true?
Yeah, the aliens crash land on Earth. They crash land on like a small American town, and you're just watching that happen or play out with people.
Oh my god, I had no idea that was the premise of.
Yeah. That's the one I've heard is like the worst. But I'm very curious about. You know, I do like some seasons of Fargo, and he was the one who created the Fargo TV show. So I'm curious about what the show could do.
Noah Hawley, we're talking about.
Yes. But I do feel like this, you know, we could be, and particularly with Alien Romulus having a really good opening weekend in the American box office, this could just be the opening the door to more and more. And the joke I made after Alien Romulus was that I just think we're like one film away from them just AI generating a young Ripley to show up in a cameo in a future film. I just think that's just what's going to happen now. So hopefully Sigourney Weaver either doesn't sign away her likeness or gets a good chance.
Well, no, they're already locked away somewhere in the Avatar vault, right? They can just access the full body scan, unfortunately.
Well, there you go. I went a little bit long in there, but I think the Alien franchise is just always fascinating to me, even though it can never, reclaim the greatness of those first two films. But thank you so much, Simon. I look forward to whenever you see Alien Romulus hearing about your thoughts. And thank you everyone for listening, and especially those who contributed and continue to contribute to RTR during this radiothon period.
Thank you, everyone.